There is a growing recognition that climate regulation is financially material. The cost of compliance can have an impact on value, and a building not subject to climate regulation today may be subject to one or several before the investor's hold period is up.
There is a wave of local and state climate regulation sweeping the nation. Soon, owners of large commercial real estate portfolios could be faced with complying to dozens of these at the same time. And federal reporting requirements are just getting started. Welcome back to Sustainability Street, our podcast on the intersection of commercial real estate and the world we live in. I'm your host, Therese Fitzgerald. For this episode, I am joined by CPE Climate and Energy Editor Anka Gajuk, and we'll bring in some insights from Yardi Energy's Randy Moss. We'll take you inside a few of the major rule changes impacting CRE. We'll start in New York, spend a little bit of time in Boston, move on to California, and then discuss the first federal climate-related disclosure requirement for the private sector. Here we go. Hi, Anka.
Hello, Therese.
Anka, as we know, I produce a monthly sustainability podcast, but sustainability and energy are your full-time beats. So thanks for being here to help unpack some of these new rules.
It's my pleasure.
Anka, so no two rules are the same, but are there any generalizations we can make about these regulations?
Well, Therese, there are a few. Each jurisdiction and ruling body has its own spin on the same general idea. Be transparent about your carbon emissions and make a plan for reducing them. And if you don't, there will be consequences, well, mainly monetary penalties. Another thing they have in common is they don't happen easily. There are lengthy rulemaking processes, and you can guarantee that there will be lawsuits before and after they are enacted. And finally, there is a growing recognition that climate regulation is financially material. The cost of compliance can have an impact on value, and a building not subject to climate regulation today may be subject to one or several before the investor's hold period is up.
I think what you're saying is that owners have to devote a lot of resources to this in making sure buildings are in compliance and watching out for which markets are next for regulation.
Along those lines, yes.
Let's start with the most historic climate legislation at the municipal level, Local Law 97 in New York City. The law was passed in 2019, and it went into effect in January of this year. But in the 11th hour, the city council gave owners a two-year reprieve on penalties. Obviously, that was a relief for some owners, but I'm sure environmental groups who really fought for this law were not too happy about that.
No, they were not happy. The landmark law requires owners of existing properties of more than 25,000 square feet to meet new energy efficiency and greenhouse gas emission limits beginning this year, and there will be stricter limits coming into effect in 2030 and 2040. All buildings must be zero emissions by 2050. The goal is to reduce emissions in the city's largest buildings by 40% by 2030 and 80% by 2050. As for penalties, owners are supposed to face fines of $268 for every emissions ton above their building's emissions limit or carbon cap. Now, they won't face those fines until 2026, and they have to submit building emissions reports starting in January 2025. Each building's carbon limit depends on its size, property type, and compliance year. Apparently, the city council was swayed by complaints from owner groups and a lawsuit from two Queens condos claiming that the cost of energy upgrades was just too high And then there are the complaints that COVID and supply chain delays were also a problem.
But the delay on penalties doesn't let owners off the hook completely, right?
No. To avoid the penalties until 2026, owners must still show good faith efforts to decarbonize their properties. They have to submit a decarbonization plan to the city by May 2025 about how they will meet the first set of limits and the more stringent standards in 2030. And like other owners, they have to submit the first annual emissions report in May 2025 on 2024 emissions. But some owners say even with the good faith process, the law is just too onerous.
The delay in fees, as we said, happened in the final hours of a rulemaking process that took 4 years. Any other noteworthy items that were added or subtracted when the final set of rules came out?
Yeah, the final rules also offers a beneficial electrification credit for property owners who replace fossil fuel heating and cooling systems with electric energy. That credit is necessary because currently electricity costs more than gas. And it clarified that renewable energy credits can only be used to offset electricity use, not fossil fuel generated energy. And if an owner is filing a good faith plan to avoid penalties, they cannot use RECs to offset their emissions during the 2024 through 2029 period. And the Department of Buildings has pledged to revisit the policy. Also, it laid out the city's efforts to help owners pay for this. The Inflation Reduction Act should help, and the city said it will pursue funding from federal sources. The state is also launching a $70 million initiative to develop window-mounted heat pumps, and there's also the $50 million Empire Building Challenge.
And I know there are some alternative pathways. I think renewable energy credits can be used to offset up to 10% of a building's annual emissions.
According to the law, owners can offset a percentage of their emissions over the limit with Tier 4 renewable energy credits. And Tier 4 are investments in renewable energy projects that must be in the city or serving the city. Yet, those RECs are not available. And when they are, the demand is expected to be so high that they will be very expensive.
How are owners coping with compliance, generally speaking?
Actually, Therese, in December, the New York City Buildings Department found 90% of these 50,000 buildings impacted are in compliance with the cap set for 2024. Owners have been closely monitoring their emissions and implementing energy updates. But it's going to get harder, with the allowable emissions thresholds dropping every 5 years. I spoke with Randy Moss, manager at Yardi Energy. Moss describes the situation like this.
Local Law 97 builds on the data collected through Local Law 84, which is the benchmarking law requiring buildings report using Energy Star Portfolio Manager. Our team at Yardi benchmarks over 10,000 buildings across North America and very comfortable and do a lot of the reporting in New York City. So we've been talking and working closely, and we have a lot of clients that have been proactive and use that benchmarking data to get ahead of the coming wave of needed improvements to meet greenhouse gas goals and avoid carbon fees. We also have had clients that have identified buildings that, because of various constraints, are not going to be able to be viable. And they've been divesting those buildings, often at a discount, to avoid those future negative cash flows.
Anka, what I've been hearing is, if you're a prominent owner who is answering to the public market or large partners and many tenants, you probably have a sustainability team and are well on your way to addressing this. But if you're a small owner without a sustainability team, You're probably struggling to figure this out. And if you're a relatively unknown entity, you may find it easier to just pay the fine.
Well, I asked Randy Moss about that too, and he seemed to think the city would not look kindly on that.
The city's regulatory wording and the discussions they've had, they take a very dim view of that, and would not surprise me to see the city change the regulations so that just paying the fine and moving on is not as attractive. That may be a short-term solution, but I would recommend they take a longer view and make sure they're not going to be surprised if we see changes in the regulation.
As promised, let's make a quick stop in Boston. How does Local Law 97 compare to the Birdo regulation, which is also very ambitious and has been referred to as Boston's Local Law 97?
Well, Boston's Building Emissions Reduction and Disclosure Ordinance also has a target of net zero emissions for impacted buildings by 2050. Like Local Law 97, Birdo began with a reporting requirement in 2013. Owners had to start reporting their energy and water consumption patterns on a yearly basis. Then in 2021, they came out with Birdo 2.0, which was a more action-oriented set of rules. And in fact, the final rules for the ordinance came out in January of this year. Like Local Law 97, the regulation requirements step up over time. Buildings between 20,000 and 35,000 square feet or residential buildings of 15 to 35 units started reporting on their energy use in 2022, but they don't have to comply with the emission standards until 2031. Buildings larger than 35,000 square feet have to start complying in 2025. Like in New York, the city does help owners who need funding to pay for retrofits, and both allow a number of different pathways. But there are a number of key differences. The first is Birdo affects 5% of Boston's building stock, which is about 4,000 buildings. Local Law 97 impacts 2% of New York City's building stock, which is 50,000 buildings. Another difference is the carbon limits for Birdo. These are measured in kilograms of carbon dioxide equivalent per square foot per year. And Local Law 97's metrics are measured in tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per square foot per year.
And these city level rules are key. When you consider buildings produce the largest percentage of emissions in cities, in New York City and Boston, I think it's like 70%. Okay, let's move on to California to talk about the state's climate accountability package, which Governor Gavin Newsom signed into law back in October. It's two laws. Tell us about them and what they mean for California companies.
Senate Bill 253, or the Climate Corporate Data Accountability Act, requires from the entities doing business in California with total annual revenue in excess of $500 million to publicly disclose their Scope 1 emissions, which is direct emissions, Scope 2 emissions, those emitted by the energy they purchase, and Scope 3 emissions, which are those emitted upstream and downstream in the value chain. The exact rules from the California Air Resources Board will come out in January next year. But what we know so far is that beginning in 2025, reporting entities will have to demonstrate their Scope 1 and Scope 2 greenhouse gas emissions. Then, beginning in 2027, they will have to report on Scope 3. And they will have to demonstrate verification of these reports by independent third-party providers.
Wow, Scope 3, that's difficult to track.
Yeah, Scope 3 is considered the holy grail in carbon reduction. Scope 3 are those emissions in your supply chain. It's the emissions of your customers and your suppliers, and implicitly the materials you get from them, basically the ones you have no control over. Well, sort of, because even in this hard-to-control emissions target, the industry is making advancements. Recently, I spoke to reps from Skanska, Concrete AI, and CP Group about ways to decarbonize concrete. Each of these entities have methods and technologies they're working on or with to create the best suited concrete recipes with just the right amount of cement, aiming to not just lower the carbon footprint, but also cut costs while maintaining the material's durability. So, in a way, there's continuity to increase sustainability from this perspective.
That's really exciting. Going back to SB 253, there are fees and fines attached to that law?
Yes, there will be an annual administration paid by the reporting entities, and there will be a fine of up to $500,000 annually for failure to comply with reporting. There will not be a penalty, however, for making mistakes in reporting Scope 3 emissions. Reports will be made publicly available on a CARB-managed website.
And the other law is SB 261?
Senate Bill 261, or the Climate-Related Financial Risk Act, requires reporting companies to disclose their climate-related financial risk and how they plan to reduce and adapt to such risk. The law takes effect in January 2026, and every 2 years after, companies must report. The reporting entity must also report this information on its own website and submit a statement to the California Secretary of State affirming compliance.
And what are the penalties for non-compliance?
Those can be up to $50,000 in a reporting year, but good faith efforts will be considered.
Okay, and there is a lawsuit trying to prevent the bill's implementation. Is that correct?
The suit was filed in federal district court in California by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, along with the American Farm Bureau Federation, the California Chamber of Commerce, Central Valley Business Federation, the Los Angeles County Business Federation, and the Western Growers Association. The lawsuit claims that the two new statutes violate the First Amendment rights of the targeted entities, because it compels businesses to engage in subjective speech about climate change, which is a political topic. The suit also claims that the law attempts to preempt the Federal Clean Air Act and the Constitution, because California would be regulating carbon emissions outside of its borders.
So this law applies to entities rather than buildings. Who is affected?
Estimates are the law would apply to around 10,000 companies. Here's what Randy Moss said.
The interesting thing about both of these laws in California is they apply to businesses doing business in the state. That does not mean businesses headquartered in California. And California defines doing business in California at their government websites. Ballpark number, if you have over $71,000 in real estate or over $71,000 in payroll in California, you are doing business. And then they want you to provide reporting regardless of location. So that's still being determined of what regardless of location means, but it, in the broadest sense, it could mean you're responsible if you are doing business in California, you're responsible to report to the state of California, possibly all of your greenhouse gas, all of your financial risk, regardless of location.
So these are really ambitious laws, Anca. But I guess that's not surprising, since California is often compared to Europe when it comes to climate action, rather than being compared to any other U.S. states or the United States as a country.
California is the largest state based on population and GDP, and it has shown its ability to drive national policy, particularly on the environmental front. It's called the California Effect.
Speaking of the California effect, didn't California try to convince the SEC not to weaken its proposed climate disclosure rules, which were actually just finalized last month?
That's correct. They did. But the SEC eventually did soften its proposal.
Tell us more about these rules.
Well, first proposed in April of 2022, the rules are designed to bring consistency and transparency to investors on climate-related risk.
Sounds constructive enough, but these rules created quite an uproar, right?
Yes. The original proposal would have required all U.S. public companies and foreign private investors that file annual reports and registration statements with the SEC to report on all greenhouse gas emissions. It would have required filers, and it still does, to report on their climate-related issues, their management of those issues, and the impact those issues have on their business strategies and consolidated financial statements. Many public companies were already reporting their greenhouse gas emissions and other non-financial impacts, particularly if you were doing business in Europe. But this would have been a big deal for two reasons. One, scope 3 emissions are extremely difficult to target. And two, typically, when it came to deciding whether a risk rose to the level of materiality, that was left up to the companies using the so-called reasonable investor standard. The original proposal would have been much more prescriptive about what needs to be reported and what didn't.
So how does the final rule differ from the proposed rule?
After 2 years and more than 24,000 comment letters, the SEC backed away from requiring Scope 3 emissions to be reported. So only direct emissions, Scope 1, and indirect emissions, Scope 2, need to be reported, while the auditing requirements on those emissions get stricter over time. And the traditional SEC definition of materiality will apply for emissions and other climate disclosures. So only material emissions will need to be reported. The timeline for compliance was also extended. It is allowing larger filers up to 2 years to provide most disclosures, 3 years to provide GHG emission information, and 6 years to obtain a limited assurance over GHG emissions. Other filers will also follow a delayed timeline. Also, it exempted from the GHG reporting requirements some companies, such as smaller reporting companies, emerging growth companies, and non-accelerated filers. The SEC also delayed disclosure until the second fiscal quarterly report for the following year. It eliminated the requirement that board expertise in climate-related issues had to be disclosed. And it also included a safe harbor provision for forward-looking statements.
Which companies are affected?
Well, that changes over time. Large SEC-registered companies that have public float greater than $700 million must start complying by 2025. Medium companies must start complying in 2026, and smaller companies in 2027.
So what is required?
As I mentioned, large filers and certain accelerated filers must disclose Scope 1 and 2 material greenhouse gas emissions. Other disclosures include the impacts of severe weather and other natural conditions on the financial statement, estimates and assumptions about how much weather and natural conditions are likely to have an impact, risk management for these impacts, governance for the climate-related risk, carbon offset and renewable energy credit information, internal carbon pricing, climate-related targets and goals on how that impacts the business, a transition plan to manage a material climate risk, as well as material climate-related expenditure and impacts.
So if I'm not a public company, do I have to worry about this?
Well, you probably do, according to Randy Moss. He says you will need to be familiar with the rules if you want to get debt or equity from a registered company.
The new SEC laws are following along, similar to what happened in Europe a few years ago. And we have seen many European investors that are being forced by the laws there to restrict funding in the U.S. to companies that do good greenhouse gas reporting, ESG reporting, if you will. So that's being forced on lenders in Europe. If they invest anywhere worldwide, they have to have certain sustainable reporting metrics. So that has resulted in clients already across North America saying, hey, we've got to do this to maintain funding and access to capital markets globally.
As a result, Randy said, many large and mid-sized public companies are already reporting emissions and other climate disclosures. So this will probably be toughest on the smaller companies that aren't reporting emissions and other climate disclosures.
And do the SEC rules preempt state laws like the ones in California?
No, they do not. No.
Anka, we know that lawsuits often follow such rulings. So is this the final word?
Well, on March 15, a U.S. appeals court granted a stay of the rules in response to a suit by Liberty Energy and Nomad Propane Services. And supposedly, there is a momentum in Congress to repeal the rules because they are considered by some to be too intrusive. But given that the SEC rule is already a compromise rule and that Europe and California have been much more aggressive, I think this rule has a good chance of surviving.
Okay, Anka, I know you will be watching those developments and reporting on them for CPE. We look forward to your coverage. Thank you for coming on Sustainability Street.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
And thank you, listeners, for joining me on Sustainability Street. If you have any questions about this episode or suggestions for future episodes, please reach out to me at therese.fitzgerald@cpe-mhn.com. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And before you go, I want to tell you about an opportunity. The CPE Executive Council is a group of industry leaders who exchange ideas about trending real estate concerns, and those discussions are later posted on our website. If you're interested in joining the council, please contact Editor-in-Chief Jessica Fuhr at jessica.fuhr@cpe-mhn.com. Bye for now.